reading of our story, which is a reading in Genesis. And if you want a new church Bible, then raise your hand. Or if you're more tech savvy than a youth pastor, you might have downloaded the app by now and installed it, and you can read along on that. So Chris is going to come and lead us in our reading.
It's on page 3 of the Church New Bibles. Genesis 1, verses 26 to 31. And then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves upon the ground." And God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth, and all the birds in the sky, and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day.
Here we go. I'm on. I'm alive and well. I don't know how you feel about the prospect of galloping through the Bible in 12 weeks, but we're not going to read every word, obviously. We're not going to study every single bit of the Bible, but the idea is we're going to think about some of the big themes in the Bible to see how the various books inside the Bible fit together and hopefully end up with an overview of what they say about God, the world, and about us, and how the three mesh together. And there's a sense in which the Bible is a bit like a TV series. I don't know if you've ever got caught up in these long-running series. I remember my teenagers, well, especially the girls, used to watch Friends. And Friends went on for years, didn't it? And they all got older and older and older. And you almost had a feeling that they might end up being really ancient wrinklies with grandchildren eventually. But actually, they stopped long before then. And there's a sense in which the Bible is a bit like a long-running TV series, where there's lots and lots of different episodes, lots and lots of different books, and there are lots and lots of stories inside each episode. If you think of anything on television that runs for a long time, there are always lots of different stories going on about the different characters in the stories, and the Bible's a bit like that. But there's one overarching story, and that's the story of God and his people. It's the story of salvation. And only the creator behind the whole series knows exactly how and when it will finish. It's a bit like Harry Potter, and of course the name of the person who wrote it's instantly gone out of my mind. But as she was writing it, she knew how it was going to end. But we would get the first part. My children devoured it. I then devoured it. And then they were waiting for the second part. And as soon as it was announced that the second part was around, they were down at the shop and buying it and couldn't read it fast enough. But none of us had any idea how it was going to finish. And actually, it's a bit like that with God's story, because it hasn't finished yet. Only God knows when the story will finish. Only he knows exactly how all the loose ends are going to be tied up. And the amazing thing is that we appear in the Bible. We're part of God's story. We're part of his story. And the Bible was written for us. It was written about us. It's full of life and truth. It has the power to challenge and change the world. It has the power to challenge and change us, because God's story isn't over yet. And today we get to look at how the story begins with Genesis' picture of the creation of the world. As I said this morning, this isn't a scientific explanation of what happened. It's a theological one through which we are introduced to God the Creator. And the book of Genesis begins with four words: in the beginning, God. And there are other writings which were created around the same time that Genesis was written, sort of parallel creation narratives. And in these ones, the world is kind of the result of either violence or cooperation between various sort of godlike figures who themselves have emerged from raw material that already somehow existed. And Genesis is totally different to this, because Genesis says God pre-existed everything else. And actually, there is a certain logic to this. If God came into existence, then someone or something would have caused this to happen, in which case God wouldn't really be God. Instead, the curtain opens to reveal God gazing over the heavens. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And there's a real sense of anticipation, of watching and waiting to see what is going to happen next. And the word Spirit is the same as the word for breath. It's the same as the word for life. And it's the same as the word for power. In other words, God is the life giver. He has power to transform what is formless. He has power to bring light into darkness. He has power to fill up what is empty. Maybe some of you are going through a patch in your life where life doesn't really have much shape. It doesn't really have much meaning. Maybe it's a bit dark. Maybe it's a bit empty. Well, God transforms what is formless. He brings light into darkness, and he fills up what is empty. And he brings everything into existence through the spoken word. It's a bit like a film director saying, lights, camera, action. God says, light. And there is light, only it's on a much bigger scale than in a film. And Genesis wants us to recognize that each step happened as part of a sequence. There's an overall pattern. There's an overall design. Our universe, the planet we live on, didn't happen as part of a random accident. It was by God's plan. And each sequence is marked by a pause. Genesis 1:16 to 19 describes God making two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth and to govern day and night and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. And just for the record, I don't have a problem describing the series of events as days, because it's just a way of measuring something that happened in stages in language that is both specific and yet fluid. God is outside time, and yet he's within it. He existed before time, but he also confined himself to it. And Jesus' life-giving spirit brought creation into being, and God's life-giving spirit still holds all things together until that time when Jesus returns. As the song says, it's your breath in our lungs, so we pour out our praise. Great are you, Lord. And 2 Peter 3:8 reminds us, do not forget this one thing, dear friends. With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like a day. And we could substitute, a day is like 1,000,000 years, or 1,000,000,000,000 years, or whatever the next thing up is. And 1,000,000 years, 1,000,000,000,000 years. Like a day. We cannot measure God, but Genesis helps us to understand our world from God's perspective. And I love the idea that God paused to reflect, to evaluate what he had done, to enjoy it because it was good, so good. Maybe also to think about what he would do next. I've got some dry land here. Okay. Why don't we put something on it? Why don't I make some plants or create some animals? Pausing is good. And if God paused, we too should pause to reflect, to ponder and to enjoy, to consider what to do next. Instead, we rush through life at breakneck speed. We don't notice what we've missed until it's too late. But anyone who creates anything pauses. It's our natural instinct. We are made in the image of God who paused. I've heard a friend say that he looks at a block of wood until the wood tells him what it should be shaped into. We all do this. We pause, we evaluate. Is this the right colour? Is it in the right place? Does this taste good? No, it needs a bit more of this or that. Should that plant go over there or should it go here? Why do we have the capacity to design, to decide what works and what doesn't? Whether we garden, cook, sew, or do wood turning, whatever it is, we pause to evaluate, to enjoy what we have made, because we are made in the image of God, the Creator. And we are blessed by programs like the BBC's Earth from Space, which enables us to see our planet in a whole new way. I've just realised I haven't switched this on. To catch a glimpse of the enormous variety of habitats around the world, Adam's ahead of me, each sustaining its own perfectly balanced ecosystem of plants and wildlife. This is the amazing bit about creation. There are so many different ecosystems, and each of them has a unique variety of plants and wildlife. And that's why it doesn't work if you take one animal from one continent and move it to the other. It just causes havoc because they don't have the right sort of natural system for keeping everything in balance. I'm awestruck by the huge variety of different species, as well as the huge variety within species, whether it be animal, bird, fish, insect, or plant. God's creation is so generous. It's so beautiful, but it's also got a real sense of playfulness about it and joy. Because God is generous and beautiful. God is playful and full of joy. And I believe that God had fun while he was creating. So God flung stars into space, But he also created the star-nosed mole, which lives underground in southeast Canada and the eastern states of the USA. Virtually blind, the mole relies on 22 rays that form a star around its snout. Now, the human hand has 17,000 nerve endings. And we know we've got them, because if you touch something hot and burn yourself, you pull your hand away instantly. It's the nerve endings that are telling you to do that. We have 17,000. The star-nosed mole crams 100,000 nerve endings into an area the size of a human fingertip. And they sort of run along their little passageways underground, and if they touch something, they can identify what it is in 0.2 seconds. They can decide within 8 milliseconds whether it's worth eating or not. And they eat faster than any other mammal on Earth. Way, way faster than any of us. And as I said this morning, you know, families are divided between those who eat quickly and those who eat slowly. And the ones who eat quickly romp through, and then they're sitting sort of twiddling their thumbs, waiting for the other ones to catch up. And the other ones, the slow eaters, just look at the fast eaters and despair. I am from a family of fast eaters. Because when I grew up, the way my mum served meals was that she'd serve all of us, but as soon as you had finished your portion, if you wanted a second helping, you got in there. And so it made sense if you were hungry to eat quickly, because then you'd get your second helping before your brothers got to it and finished it before you could have any. So we all eat incredibly fast. My husband's family were obviously much more civilized at mealtimes, because the rule in their family was nobody can have any second helpings until your mother has finished eating. So it didn't make any sense for Joe and his brothers to eat quickly. They wouldn't get seconds until Elizabeth, my mother-in-law, had finished her plateful of food. And as she was the last person to be served, they would have had to wait a long time. Consequently, Joe eats slowly. I think he chews every mouthful 100 times. I once started counting him, and it was a really sad evening that evening. And I'm thinking, I'm ready for my pudding, and you barely started. Well, the next time he tells me I'm a really speedy eater, I'll say, the star-nosed mole is faster than I am. Then there's the mantis shrimp, which isn't a shrimp, nor is it a praying mantis, but a different species altogether. When it's hunting prey, their fists are spring-loaded, able to accelerate from their body at over 50 miles an hour, delivering a force of over 1,500 newtons. I've no idea what a newton is, but it sounds rather splendid. Enough to smash through a glass aquarium or a crab shell. So people apparently quite like keeping these little creatures, which are only 4 inches long, in aquariums, but they have to get plate glass aquariums so that the little guys don't bash their way out of it. They punch at 2,500 times the force of their own weight. And if a human being could do this, we'd be able to punch through steel. And obviously, that's going to exert a lot of force on their clubs. And apparently, inside their clubs are special layers of a substance that acts as a shock absorber. And their cell structure has been studied by manufacturers of car frames, aircraft panels, and advanced body armor for combat troops. Mantis shrimps have the most complex eyes in the animal kingdom, which sit on mobile stalks, each independent of each other. They can see better with one eye than we can with two, or than I can with four. They have 3 times more color photo receptors than we do. and they're able to detect a type of special spiraling light which they use to communicate with each other. We have technology to do the same, but the mantis shrimp beat us to it by as much as 400 million years. As for their reproductive lives, some mantis shrimp species are monogamous. I challenge you to say mantis shrimp species. It's really difficult. They remain with the same partner for up to 20 years. They live together in the same burrow, and both male and female take care of the eggs. So there you have it. They're colourful, they're deadly, but they're long-lasting, faithful partners who are great with little ones. Now, if God gives such intricate care and attention to two creatures that are just 4 inches long, and one of them lives underground and is hardly ever seen, and the other one's at the bottom of the ocean, how much more care does he give to us? When it comes to creating humankind, God goes up to a different level. What is it that makes us so unique and so special to God? Well, I've already mentioned it. We alone are made in God's image. Genesis 1:26, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his image. In the image of man, of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. For Genesis to write that male and female together comprise the image of God is radical and extraordinary in a patriarchal culture. At the very beginning of God's book, God says men and women are equally made in his image. Neither is lesser nor greater. Yes, we are different, but God makes no distinction between us, and neither should we. Equally radical and extraordinary is God's decision to give us his authority and power to rule, to share God's work of keeping order over the world, to bless the world. And the word that's used for rule means to protect, to promote well-being. In other words, we're to use our position and power to bring blessing. And this is the nature of true kingship. This is the highest expression of God's love for us and his trust in us. And the highest expression of our love for God is when we obey his command to protect and bless his world. So God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. And subdue has caused all sorts of horrendous behaviors and attitudes. But subdue is not about abuse. It's about taking control in order to bring greater fruitfulness. And then it's a care thing. And an analogy might be when I prune my rose pergola, when I care for it, when I cut out the diseased wood and train all the other wood and cut out the weak wood so that the plant is healthier and brings even more flowers this year than it will do last year. It's not carte blanche to destroy creation to fuel our selfish desires. God's overarching command is that we love his creation and we bless it and we honor it, just as God loves us and wants to bless us. And he honors us by trusting us to do it. I had this picture in my mind of God discussing it with the heavenly hosts. You know, when he says, let us make man in our own image, and all the angels around him going, what? You're going to do what? You're going to share your image with these creatures? You're going to share your power with them? You must be off your trolley. And God's saying, well, no, I think it might work. I think I'm going to have a go. You know, I'm really up for this. I think it's going to be good. I want to do it. It's extraordinary that he trusts us in this way. And our response to this gift should be humility. And Psalm 8, verses 3 to 6 says this: when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them. You have made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet. God has put everything under our feet. He trusts us with his beautiful creation. But there's even more. He graces us with his love. He's created us for relationship with him, as well as relationship with each other. And we'll be exploring more of what this means over the coming weeks. But I want to finish with a psalm that reminds us just how precious we are to God. Our universe is vast beyond our imagining. But God's story tells us that we are important to him. That across the galaxies, he can see us. He sees us in every intricate part of who we are. He sees us in a way that is intimate and close and precious. No detail is hidden from him. And he hears us. He understands us. And he has such plans and dreams for us that he wants to bring into being. And this isn't meant to be scary, this idea that God can see us and hear us and knows what we're thinking, because it's all held together with love. He just wants to bless us. Psalm 139 says this: O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? Even the darkness will not be dark to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. How often do we stop and think about that? We are extraordinary. God says to each one of you, you are extraordinary. You are extraordinary. You are extraordinary. You're extraordinary. You're wonderful. You're awesome. You're fantastic. That's what he says to us. That's how he feels about us. Each one of us is beautiful and precious in his eyes. But we find that so hard to believe about ourselves. We find it much easier to believe that other people are precious to God. And we also think, how can God love me? He knows me too well. He knows all my faults. He knows all my failings. But I can imagine how he can, love someone else.